Welcome back, everyone, to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Rochelle, and I am so excited to be with Anita Archer for the season finale. We've gone through so many episodes, something like 30 episodes a season for quite some time. And it has been my absolute privilege and joy to bring this show to you. It is literally just a passion project that takes up a great deal of my time, but I love every moment of it because it's the best professional learning I've ever done. Just being able to sit across the Zoom meeting world with some of the best experts in education, and to be able to talk and refine some of the things that have just been important to me and what I've seen with working with kids, especially the kids who need great teaching the most. Just before we turn over to Anita Archer, I just wanted to plug my Explicit Teaching Institute, which is happening the last week of July 2026 and probably forevermore in New York City. You'll see the link to it and the tickets, and I think it's the cheapest ticket in town. I really want to fill that room, and there's just a few more tickets left, but I keep hearing people are signing up large groups and so on. So go ahead and check out that link. I know it's directly probably in competition with what Anita does, but I think she's here. She'll give me some grace for putting out workshops just like her excellent institute. Anita, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How are you doing today?
I am doing terrific, Zach. I am thrilled to be with you and to end the school year with you.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. There are somehow folks that maybe haven't encountered your work before, but tell me a little bit how you got into this space and what you're doing currently.
So, Zach, I've had a career of about 59 years. And so that's a long career, but it started out at University of Washington. And at that time, University of Washington had an experimental education unit that did research on instruction at the very detailed level by applied behavioral analysis folks. And so I got involved there. I worked on a master's, then I taught special ed using all of the knowledge that I had. And then I went to the university really young, 26, and joined the faculty as a assistant, and then got a master's. And then I moved to Eugene, Oregon, and I was blessed then to teach at University of Oregon in the education department with all the people from follow through to get to teach explicit instruction reading book that was authored by Doug Carnide, a good friend. Then I taught explicit instruction. Then I went to San Diego State, taught explicit instruction. For the rest of my career, which is continuing, writing books, writing curriculum materials, having the great blessing of working with school districts, state departments, countries on improving their instruction. So it has been that my mission, like you have a mission, and a consistent focus again and again at all of those levels, the academic level, I'm still involved with colleges, the school level, I work with school districts at the state level or the district level, and then do lots of training, yes, instructional week trainings, many of them this year in Portland and other places across the country. So we are both blessed to be in the best work possible, with great teachers, administrators, and it is a blessing.
You mentioned your relationship with like some of the greats, Doug Carnine, the University of Oregon, the follow-through folks. So mm-hmm. We'll definitely put that towards the end, but I'm very excited to see, you are a longtime speaker at the NIFTY conference in Eugene, Oregon. So I'm very excited to see you there.
Both be there.
I'm so excited. So the first time I ever found your work, it has to be, I think most people maybe see a video here and there. Mine was actually someone directed me to the first chapter of your book, which is freely available on your website. Someone gave me the link, and I think it's called Foundations of Explicit Instruction, that chapter, but it certainly gives a great overview. Could you maybe give us sort of the core tenets or principles that make up explicit instruction? I know that the definition of that could be different for different people and so on. So maybe you could break that down for us.
You know, when you sent me questions, thank you very much. So that I always believe in teachers preparing for what they're doing and me preparing for what I'm doing. And when I saw the core principles, I thought back about all of the people that I've worked with over time and their view of instruction at the biggest level. And then we'll look at what's related to explicit instruction. But they start out with the strong belief that every child can learn. And when they're not learning, instead of looking at them, we need to look at the quality of our instruction. Is the content critical? Is the instruction explicit with very good demonstrations, with teachers having the language that will be understood? Are they then moving into guided practice, where they guide the students in practicing it, or they provide scaffolding and gradually fade that out, and then move on to independent practice, where the practice is very deliberate, and it is spaced over time. All of what we know from two bodies of research, the science of instruction that looked at what do expert teachers do and can we replicate it, to the science of learning, how do students learn? And so it is that scope of making it very explicit, meaning I am going to tell you the information. I'm not going to have you discover it. I'm the expert, you're the novice. No matter what grade you're in, you do not know this knowledge, and I need to be more precise in my instruction so that you will get it. For my teaching years, which I have taught many years, long ago, I started taking big ideas and putting them into mottos that were memorable. So, if you'll excuse me, I'll just share some Archerisms that go with this. Okay. Number one, how well I teach equals how well they learn. Now, both of us believe in this direct relationship that the quality of instruction definitely equals the probability of learning occurring. And learning, we both know, is when information has been rehearsed and retrieved often enough that it is in permanent memory and can be used to support other learning. But that relationship, very, I mean, all teachers need to understand this and live by it, that my teaching makes a difference in your attainment. And teach the stuff and cut the fluff. So explicit instruction hones right in on what's going to be most useful to you, what vocabulary terms to teach, what strategies in math to teach that are generalizable and work, that the content does make a huge difference. And long ago, in a book that a chapter that I wrote, I coined the terms. I do it, we do it, you do it. But basically, it is sort of the course that we take in explicit instruction. I do it, I present new information very directly. I'm not praying that you will discover it. I'm going to ensure that what humans do is teach it. And I'm going to have language that you understand. I'm going to have explanations that you know. Maybe I've read your book. Just tell them. I'm going to demonstrate it step by step. I might give you a model. Look at this problem and do a parallel problem, a worked problem. And then we do it so that I'm not just going to go from I taught it, now you do it. I taught it, now we're going to do it. So I'm going to go through it with you Maybe it's a strategy, and I say the first step is now do it. The second step is do it very direct. Or maybe it is a rule, and we will apply it by asking you questions on it. But it will be scaffolded practice, it will be guided practice, it will be gradually faded, that gradual release of responsibility to you do it, where you apply it independently. And along with that, we need lots of active participation. Cognitive science tells us that. The science of instruction tells us that good instruction is interactive. I say something, you say something, I write something, you write something. And for this adage, I borrow from a good friend of mine, Dr. Kevin Feldman, who had one that simply said, everyone does everything. Everyone does everything. So we move away from kids raising their hands and calling on them. Because then we end up calling on certain children often and other children never. Everybody puts up their whiteboard. Everybody puts up their fingers for an answer. Everybody says the answer together and choral responses. Everybody reads a sentence together. That we have everyone does everything. But along with that, in explicit instruction, there is a rhythm to instruction that I constantly have to remember when I am teaching. That there is input and a question, and then a response that we carefully listen to and monitor and give feedback. And probably one of the things that, again, both the science of instruction and the science of learning say is give feedback. Our motto is feedback feeds forward. Feedback, whether it is affirmative, telling you, and particularly specific praise, and then it is also going to be corrective in many cases, feedback. And finally, we have lots of practice. And this is one of the challenges of many times in instruction when I visit schools and look at their gains, is that they did the initial instruction, but they didn't pair it with enough independent practice. That was deliberate practice. That was spaced over time. That was coupled with feedback. So it's like sort of this whole package of behaviors that are necessary for good explicit instruction. Yes, we think of someone teaching it directly, but then all of the other attributes go with it.
And I think that's probably why, great job breaking it down for us, by the way. I should always praise, right? I thought it was excellent. But I think that's why explicit instruction defies a label or is often misconstrued by folks because there are so many moving parts as a system, a full system from beginning and middle to an end, that it's so much easier to characterize it as a single move. Yes, I do that. I do explicit instruction, but when I watch the teacher doing it, they're just giving little bits of help to students one at a time, and the whole rest of it is not there. And it certainly isn't explicit instruction from the way you just defined it.
You know, Zach, I totally agree with you. It is not a one and done. It's not quick like that. It is a whole process. And you see it in research validated programs that have really looked at how to use all of these principles within it. There's much to know.
And it's also said that explicit instruction must be like easier, I suppose. It's like sort of denigrated in the sense that like it's a low level method or something. But when you just said all of those things, I'm over here writing down, like, I'm just thinking, well, if you don't have behavior in place, that is going to be challenging.
Right.
If your pacing isn't right, it's going to slow it down and motivation's going to dip. It's a challenging methodology to master.
Absolutely. And it is not simple. It's hard work. And the more our curriculum materials embrace it and embed it, then it is easier for teachers to do it. But the outcome is learning. And this is the whole point of teaching, is learning. And so, in fact, as Siegfried Engelmann used to say, if they have not learned it, you have not taught it, which means that it does take more than just an introduction and move on, an introduction to something and move on, and the students end up with nothing that is in permanent memory.
Excellent. I have a ton of questions to ask you, things that I don't know if you've answered elsewhere. And I have been sort of, stalking you across all the different podcasts you've been on for from the very beginning. But I think some of these things can clarify certain topics for the audience, if you'll
Yeah,
indulge me.
I'll
One
indulge you.
one of them is I feel like there's a tension between what you said about just now about great programs, and then the fact that some teachers don't have great programs, and so they have to plan things for themselves. So, first of all, before we even dive into how to plan something, what is your take on this? Like the use of rigorous programs like capital DI programs versus largely having a system which is completely teacher generated. I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, first of all, yes, there are programs that have utilized all of these traits, have field tested them, and utilized them. So you mentioned direct instruction materials like corrective reading, corrective mathematics, reading programs, or even ones I've written are research validated and they are explicit intervention programs. And so that is at one end. And the other end of the continuum is teachers make up their own curriculum. Now, that would be like saying to a physician, "I heard you have surgery tomorrow. It'll be really useful if you go to your basement and weld up a scalpel." No, we must give teachers the tools that support them and guide them with the right content, with the right examples, with information on how to have practice appropriate. And so we need to have curriculum materials embrace what we know about learning, embrace what we know, and embed it in the tools. So are they getting better? They are moving that way, but the actual looking at the materials and choosing them, looking at the strands to be certain that they're sequential, looking at the instruction to see if it has clear language that is repeated over time, looking at the explicitness of the demonstrations, looking at the guided practice that occurs, looking at the subsequent practice that maybe doesn't occur, but you need to add it. We need tools from curriculum that embrace it. Which would then support teachers. They're always going to have to bring their brilliance in connecting to the students and having the perky pace and maintaining attention throughout the whole lesson. It's a really hard job, but it could be supported. I do not want teachers to go to teachers pay teachers and try to put it together. It demands so much more. As a person who's written curriculum materials that take years to write and to field test and to rewrite, I know this. And so, yes, but teachers have it, and they might have a GI program, or likely not. And they might have subject areas that every subject area, the math, the reading, the science, the social studies, needs good instruction. So you want to know how to make those work better.
Well, I certainly agree with you on on having these great programs. I guess we should spend some time maybe for those folks in here who are like, well, look, I teach shop or I teach ninth grade science, and there's no program in place here, and there should be, but I can't advocate for myself. Like, one of my favorite chapters of your book is the planning chapter because I can like use that in these cases. You don't have a reading, a phonics program, or a great math program, or you have something that is it's such hot garbage, is what I call it, that it's almost impossible to like take it apart, you have this ability to maybe reconfigure it and plan from some starting principles. What would you suggest for a teacher in that position?
Okay, first, we'll assume that their district has purchased a curriculum for math and hopefully viewed it from the instructional point of view, the content and the instruction, that they chose the best one that would meet these. And so the first thing that I would look for is on the strands that are in the math program or in the science program or in the social studies program, did they break it down into obtainable pieces? So that the students have more probability of learning it. And both of the sciences that we come from say, break it down, break it down, break it down, break it down. So recently, I was sitting with a group of teachers, and they were in fifth grade. And I said, what is the next material that you have to teach? What is the next math concept? And they said, it was being able to plot coordinates on a grid. And I said, oh, and so what is the first lesson? Well, we're giving them a grid with the x-axis and the y-axis, and both of them are numbered, the columns are numbered, the rows are numbered, and they have to plot. I said, oh, so you're starting with the outcome that you intentionally want, but maybe we should like break it down. And so, luckily, we had a number of math programs, and I pulled out one that the district is going to utilize in the next year, which is Jump Math. And we open it up to the fifth grade coordinate lesson. And they start by having just dots and numbers on the side, no x-axis, no y-axis. And they say, this is a column. Ta-da! You're going to draw a line on column that is two, column three, column four. Then they introduce rows. This is a row. And then they put them together. We could use a column and a row to find a point on the grid. But it's still it's not. And so they practice that. And then they give them the coordinates and they have to make a dot on it. I mean, this was broken down into obtainable pieces, leading to the kids being introduced to sometimes we call it a x-axis and a y-axis, but we always say the column first and then the row. When you plot anything, no matter your whole life, column, row, column, row, column, row. And I thought that, I mean, the other one, you'd be like cognitive overload, just too much information coming at you. So that I look at, did they look at the intentional outcome and did they break it down into obtainable pieces? Then I look at the instruction. Let's say I'm going to teach a lesson. And in the opening of a lesson, I would tell them the goal. Did they mention it? Did they use student terms? Could I use that? And since I'm teaching novices, I would look through it to see what language they suggest. Is it language that they'll understand? Is it clear, concise, and consistent? Those are the three C's that we use for language: clear, concise, consistent. And then for new information, you would look for the explanations, the demonstrations, the modeling of it, which is what most people look at when they think of explicit instruction. But then you'd look at the guided practice. You know, does the guided practice gradually fade out the scaffolding until the students were more independent? And then you look and hope to find some practice that is spaced and practice that is deliberate and practice that will get it to permanent memory. And all the time, are there any hints about active participation? The teacher has to take their knowledge and say, okay, I know what makes a difference. And I have to do look at what curriculum I've been given, and I need to enhance or augment it to make a difference. Now, there are materials that come out that are much easier to add that layer on of good instruction. and others that are so poor that you can't even resurrect them. Teachers who have been well taught explicit instruction, the details of it, can look at it and make those kind of decisions. Now, I'm often asked this, should we have our teachers write out lesson plans? I find that is effort that is not well spent. If you have a curriculum and you're looking for these critical areas, your best bet is to augment it, to go through and highlight the language you're going to use, highlight the objective. So you're looking at that curriculum, which often has verbosity built in. Annotation of curriculum is one of the best ways for teachers who are using non-scripted programs to teach it and plan it.
It's tough because you mentioned a few things in there that are I found a challenge, right? And a lot of this might come down to like upstream, whoever was evaluating these programs should have done this for other folks, right? Should have done it for the teachers on their behalf.
I
But
know, but we're moving away from how pretty it looks to how well it teaches.
yeah. That's what it is. Or in like in actually reading the words that the teacher needs to say or convey, looking at the examples and not is it does it have a script? Like I think it was I think it was my friend Marcy Stein who was saying that like at University of Washington Tacoma, she used to give a student teachers different programs and she'd say which of these are explicit. And they would just pick the ones with scripts, right? And she, no, we need to read the scripts. We need to look at what it's doing,
That's
which I think
right.
is. So you convey this material to them in terms of like a very, inform them of the learning objective. What are some other sort of phases of the lesson planning process? Like, how should teachers think about planning instruction, especially perhaps you, if you don't have a resource really available to you?
If you don't have a resource available to you, find one. I mean, it would be like saying, you're in the kitchen, but you have absolutely no tools for the kitchen. Get some. Use your intelligence to look at it. Of what and intelligence, I mean, informed information to look through it. But it is too demanding to do it with nothing. I honor teachers greatly and respect them greatly, but I do not want all of them to feel they have to be a curriculum designer. And I want the, I have so often, I've had administrators say, well, they're professionals, they can do it. Well, they are professionals. But like any professional, they learn to use the best tools possible. And that's how a dentist carries out his or her work. That's how a doctor does it. That's how a legal lawyer does it. They utilize tools.
I absolutely agree. But the one area that I think is common across almost every subject is you have to teach vocabulary. And vocabulary, the words that you know determine how you can access text, how you can engage with others at a cocktail party, all, and it spans like your ability to access a museum and what's inside it. It's just a heavy hitter with lots of mileage. So when I think of your work, I often gravitate to your vocabulary stuff. So my question is, what does strong, explicit vocabulary instruction look like in practice?
Okay, so when I got that question, I said, in practice, well, that means I'm going to have to teach you a vocabulary word to illustrate it. Forgive me. But you are absolutely right, that one of the most predictive aspects of comprehension when you read is the vocabulary that you know you understand and can understand in that context. When you write, your vocabulary is critical to that. So it has to be a part of the day. We even know that the quality of teachers' language makes a difference in the language that children gain in that environment. That the use of academic language makes a difference in terms of students' actual future in other classes. And we know that teaching vocabulary before they read increases their comprehension. So one of the things you're going to find in most materials is routines for teaching vocabulary. And I have worked with people where they've really turned around middle school and high school by simply saying every day in every class, all teachers will teach vocabulary. The music teacher, the art teacher, everybody's going to be a part of it because it is the foundation of our reading and our writing. And in elementary classes, we're going to teach vocabulary in math. We're going to teach it in science. We're going to teach it in social studies. So when Charles Hughes and I wrote the book, which we're now revising, which will take a while, Explicit Instruction, Effective, Efficient Teaching, we looked at all the studies we could find on routines for vocabulary and adopted one that could be used across grade levels, across instruction, where number one, the teacher introduces the pronunciation of the words. Now that's really important because many words that we teach, the students have neither heard or said. So that the pronunciation, if you cannot pronounce it, you cannot attach meaning to it, store it in cognition, and use it. So pronunciation. Number two, you introduce the meaning of the word, but you utilize clear, concise, consistent language so that they will understand it. Some of the definitions I've seen in books, you would not be able to gather up what the meaning, the essence of the word was. Number three, you will illustrate it with examples and non-examples. Examples of the usage of the word, particularly utilizing the context it will appear in the reading. You will use non-examples in some cases to establish sort of the borders of the concept so that this is what it is, this is what it isn't, and one of the attributes are missing in the non-examples. And then you ask questions to practice it and also to check students' understanding. And that's the kind of gift that both of us need to give to teachers because that's a routine. I can think every time, pronunciation, meaning, examples and non-examples, check understanding. And so no matter what curriculum I'm using, I extract the words that they need, and I am very careful. It's the words critical to the context they're going to use. It's words that they can use in the future. It is words that will enlighten them. When you said, though, what does it look like in practice? I laughed because I'm not able to like demonstrate for them, so you're going to become my only student. And I chose to teach a lesson that I did with fourth grade teachers that was in just had a word and definition in their core program.
I am
Okay, you get
so
ready
excited. I am very excited.
to.
This is a great surprise. I'm very excited.
It's a great surprise. So, pronunciation. Students in our story today, our main character is going to enhance his soup that he is making. He's going to enhance it. So we need to know the word enhance. What's the whole word?
Enhance.
Enhance. Yes. Put your hand on your table. We're going to slow it down and say the syllables of the word. And everybody, enhance. And together, enhance. Good job. One more time and say it out loud. Enhanced.
Enhance.
Good job. Teacher talk. We often forget this step, but they need to pronounce it accurately so they can attach meaning to it. Okay? Meaning. Listen, when you make something that's already pretty good, better, you enhance it. When you make something that is good, better, you enhance it. So when you make something better, that is already pretty good. You
Enhance it.
enhance it. Excellent. Let's listen to some examples. Let's say you are cooking soup, as will the main character in our story, and you add more spices. You, what, everyone?
Enhance it.
You enhance it. You decide to read more outside of school, like good fourth graders would, and you're reading, 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 and as a result, you enhance your vocabulary. You do what? You in
Enhance it.
New enhancing. If you add a border to a poster, and it's a bright color, and everybody looks at it, it was good before, but it's even better now.
Enhance it.
You enhance it. Excellent job. And so let us practice using the word enhance. I'm going to give you a sentence starter and you're going to end it. My turn first. I say, I can enhance the beauty of my painting by using brighter colors. Oh, that was a good idea. I can enhance the beauty of my painting by getting a better frame around it. Oh, that would enhance it. That would make it better. It was already good, but it makes it better. I, what, everyone?
Enhanced it.
Enhance it. Good. Okay, now it's your turn. I can enhance the taste of my sandwich by, and think of the whole thing. I can enhance the taste of my sandwich by, and then I would say, one's turn to your partner, tell your sentence, two's tell your sentence, and then I call, Zach, what is your sentence?
I can enhance my sandwich by adding condiments to it.
Condiments, good use of words. What would be one condiment?
I definitely like mustard and mayo for sure.
Excellent. I can enhance a short sentence that I wrote by. Think about it. I can enhance a short sentence that I wrote by.
I can enhance
Okay.
my short sentence that I wrote by adding a comma and making it a compound sentence.
Making it a compound sentence. Good job using what we're learning in class. Beautiful. My one more, I can enhance my soccer skills by.
I can enhance my soccer skills by practicing at home on my patio.
So here we saw practice using the meaning of the word, and there are certain instances where you use the word enhance, like enhance beauty, enhance learning, enhance skills, enhance sounds, and so forth. So I covered some of those. Now, but this is not going to be enough. We would probably want to introduce related words: enhance, enhanced, enhancing, enhancement. We might introduce synonyms: improve, increase, brighten, decorate, upgrade, all synonyms to enhance. But we might also review words. And on a subsequent day, a little bit over time, remember that space practice and usage. And I'm going to start using it. Now, I just read this paragraph, and I think you could enhance it by telling more about the character. So then the teacher starts using the words, and then students start using the word. But you see the intention. Enough of it. It is systematic, nothing lost. We're not just like telling stories. We are really getting down enhance. And see, I picked the word from the fact that I had just designed lessons with the teachers on the word enhance. I picked it because that is what we have to constantly do with our teaching. We have to intentionally enhance our own teaching if we're going to become experts. So I'm working this year on just the concept of managing really attention in the room. This is my big focus on because I need to get better. No matter how many years I practice teaching, I need to get better. So I am really working on that. And so teachers need to pick out something like vocabulary instruction and really put intense work on it that is conscious. That I am working on it, I am doing better, and so forth. That's why I was working with these teachers on vocabulary.
That was awesome. A couple of things kind of stand out there that I think is are might be unusual to folks was that you, instead of having me say yes or no to all of those questions, you made me say enhance because it like sort of was doing double duty in the sense that I have to start acquiring the pronunciation of it, right?
Oh boy, isn't that, you noticed that? Excellent job, Zach, because that is true. It's not just yes or no. I need to have you say enhance, 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 enhance. And I want you also to utilize sentence stems, because sentence stems that the students then answer, any question I could give a sentence stem, they could complete it and say the whole thing. Now we are working on the language of academics. We are working on complete sentences. We're working on syntax. So sentence stems are very useful, because if you said to children, what might you enhance? They might say, well, like taste. Yeah, maybe this. Okay, I was thinking maybe this. And they don't ever say enhance. And the probability of you enhancing your language by never saying it is very low.
Another thing I noticed was your use of the word listen ahead of a meaty thing that the student would need to
Yeah.
do or say. And you just said, listen, I went down to the store and I, so you have to use that, but that there's a level of wait time, but it's not at the end like you often think. It's actually there's a cue to get everybody's attention, which matches your focus on attention lately. I thought that
Right.
that was quite excellent. I think the last thing I would ask about that routine is
Yeah.
it can feel long if you did that for every word that any kid would ever need to learn or encounter. Like, so how do you sort through something that gets the full routine versus something that just gets a brief paraphrasing or mention? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And so, in fact, research shows that if you have a session that you need 4 words or less. And that was probably that lesson I just took probably took about 6 minutes. And so you look at the words and you say, number one, which words are unknown? There's no reason to teach known words. Okay. Number two, which words are critical words that are utilized in the passage? Now, some of them I can just teach when we get to that, telling them the word, and just do what we call fast mapping, just a little definition. But others meet the next criteria. Could I utilize that word? See, we picked out enhance because the teachers in fourth grade said that's often the problem. The children are so focused on doneness, just to get this sentence written, just to get this paragraph written. And it would be acceptable, except it needs to be enhanced. So they're able to use that word constantly. You introduce the character, but now enhance the paragraph by telling about the characteristics, the appearance of that character, so people can grasp it, enhance it. So that it was a word that we could use. And it's kind of a cool word because, oh, mom, you enhanced it by putting parsley on my plate. I mean, and then their parents are saying, oh my God, what an educated kid. Let me vote for a bond issue. They're so smart. But that was not randomly chosen. It was chosen because it was necessary in the story. It was a word that they could utilize. The concept, adding to it, making it better, was a good concept, and the word would be very useful for them. And I bet they haven't heard it a lot.
And that makes a lot of sense to me. And also, I think that the fact that you're pre-teaching this word ahead of it coming up, maybe one of the things that people might bring up with reading stories is that I feel like I'm breaking this story up too much when I'm teaching words and meaning and comprehension in the middle of a text, where this
Yeah.
actually makes it so can become a real nice like retrieval opportunity for the kids because you pre-taught it ahead of getting it in context.
Right. Yes. And vocabulary needs to be a major focus in schools. I always say, don't commit a suicide, assuming that they know what are parallel lines. Teach it. Don't assume that they know a word, any word. Teach it.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me be a student. I hope people can see that I modeled that kind of practice and rehearsal because
Yes, you did a beautiful job.
we do it a lot in what I think is what I would say is characterized as good training. I think involves deliberate, active practice during the training, which sort of brings us to our next question. We want to help teachers get better at this. And there just seems to be a lot of problems with the pipeline, with teacher prep, and a lot of teachers are coming in very ill prepared for the first days of school. And then they might even go many, many years sort of, and just start blaming things that are unproductive and so on, and and kind of crashing out, burning out. So what kind of advice would you give leaders who are trying to improve teaching and embed some of these explicit teaching practices?
Okay, I'm just going to take an example of one district I'm working with. Many of them attended, their staff and all the principals and assistant principals attended a week-long training that I did on explicit instruction. And then I worked with them all this year. Having the big picture is critical, but in terms of a school-wide initiative, a school-wide focus, we have to ask ourselves what is most critical that we are going to attend to, attend to, attend to. So the first thing we looked at was setting up an environment that would be supportive of explicit instruction, like students in rows, students facing the teacher, nothing up in front that's going to distract them, and all of those things that would make a difference in terms of the environment. And then we talked about managing behavior by introducing the expectations for each activity. What are the expectations when we have whole group? What are the expectations, small group? What are the expectations in saying answers to a partner? What is the expectations during independent work? So we have the environment and management of behavior, and then management of attention. So, we know attention is very fragile, and that distractions can reduce, increase cognitive load, and reduce your attention. And so, some teachers go out to Michael's and get every cute thing that they could find to put in their room to decorate it. And I just want to say to them, save the money, save the time. And instead, dedicate those days before school starts with going over your guidelines for expectations, going over the initial lesson so you can start teaching right away. You don't have to put it off for 2 weeks. Teach right away so that they have that kind of vision. And then we have fewer distractions, but distractions on students' desks. I had a question at that meeting. What about water bottles? I said, math is starting. Everything is put away except your paper, your book, your pencil, and your whiteboard, all that stuff, anything else, and put your water bottle on the floor. And you can have it when we finish the math lesson because it's a distraction. And then we talked about interruptions. Interruptions on the intercom, someone coming into the class. And you know this research well, that when you have an interruption, and maybe it just is the principal coming in and talking to you for 30 seconds, but then they leave. And you have this problem that an interruption has like a tail, and you have to actually stop and say, okay, we are learning again the word enhance. So enhance is when something's pretty good, but you make it better. So when it's pretty good and you make it better, you enhance it. Let's go on and practice it. You have to bring them back to the content because they won't automatically come back to that point. So you look at distractions, you look at interruptions, and then you are also reminded that it is not just fragile, our attention, but it's contagious. And so, yes, you are right. When students are sitting around and someone is being very inattentive, they may join them and be inattentive. When students are very attentive, looking at the teacher, paying attention to the teacher, then that makes a difference. So the thing that I'm saying here is to educators, leaders, is at the beginning of the school year, before the kids get there, you need to go over the environment and what makes a difference. go over how to manage behavior and what makes a difference, and how to manage attention. And you can also manage attention by teaching children the behaviors of attention. You're looking at the speaker, you're sitting up, you are following directions immediately, and you're being a hero to everybody around you as a model of attention. Okay, so that's the first thing. Okay, question?
Yeah, I would you say that you like kind of assess when you're working with schools like the starting point? Because like this one could definitely be helpful for a school that is dealing with inattentiveness and bad behavior, but maybe that's something that's more widespread. Other schools might be further on the journey. Yeah, I'm curious about kind of your thought process on that.
Well, so this was a situation where I worked with the administrators at the school district level, as well as their coaches, to see what we were going to do. But I will tell you, I don't care what school you're in, if you do not attend to the environment, managing the behavior, and managing attention, you're going to have management problems that interfere with you, that take your energy away, that makes it unpleasant for the children, that reduces their learning. So this is like paramount. And so it's you might not have, maybe you've had a plan in mind and all you need to do is remind of the plan. Maybe you've had never a plan, you've never done management at your school formally, so that everybody's on the same page, then you need to do it. So, yes, there would be a continuum of emphasis based on what's already happening. And so, when I worked with the administrators, they would say, oh, we already have kids in rows. We already have no distractions. We already know how to take on interruptions, so that we were able to reduce the amount of time spent. And other schools say, we never mention those things. They might know all of those elements we've talked about in explicit instruction, but if you are really going to engage the whole school, you might want to narrow the focus that is your greatest intensity. And that school district picked the one that we found consistently made the most difference, and that is increasing opportunities to respond. The research is so great on this, whether we look at the research in general ed, in elementary or secondary, or we look at special ed, elementary or secondary. The rate at which the teacher has that input, question, response, monitoring, feedback, that kind of rhythm in their instruction makes a huge difference. So that we're looking for, we principals go in, take data, coaches go in and take data, the teachers themselves look at their videos, take data, peers come into their room, take data. During the time that they're providing lessons, not during independent practice. And we look at the research, and they even give us some guidelines that in normal situations, excellent, high performing teachers in terms of student gains have like 3 to 5 responses in a minute. See, it's not like one response per hour. It is much more than that. And if I was teaching foundation skills, like letter sound associations, or in reading, or maybe math facts where we're practicing it, it might be more like 8 to 12 responses per minute. So, why did we pick this one? Oh, well, the research would suggest it, but there's another reason. If you increase active participation, you have to know what you're teaching. You have to have in mind how you're going to proceed. You have to know what kind of language you're going to use, what kind of questions you're going to employ in the classroom. So it affects everything. And so over time, we never get rid of that, but we might add other focuses, like increasing the intentionality of vocabulary instruction. But it has to be at the school level, because you asked about leadership. It has to be something that you can still have everybody involved. General ed, special ed, music, art, PE, all of them could do opportunities to respond. All of them could have vocabulary instruction.
And I think that that's what it is. It's I think we often want to go like deep into certain areas of teacher development that I think are important, right? And you know, deep into the subject, you know, kind of split us all off and we're all doing different things. But when you, often enough, when you go into schools that really need support or are just ambitious enough to get over this kind of like, I don't know, it's just sort of the mediocrity of the kind of going through the motion school. You look around the school and you see the kids aren't paying attention. They're not listening and they're not being recruited to think. They're all passengers in this and they need to be active participants. You know, we need to get them there. It's so great. It's so cool. One more question about this before we kind of talk about this summer, and that is, we've talked about some unpopular opinions, I think, in education, and you've had a much longer career than I've had, and I imagine these have always been around. Things like teachers should plan their own lessons from scratch, teachers shouldn't adopt a method that's so direct or so teacher dependent or led, and these arguments go round and round. I'm curious how you weather that, how you deal with it, maybe passing that information on to us who are sort of taking on this work anew.
Yes, I mean, when you have taught this many years, I was at University of Oregon and I was teaching literacy there, and I was teaching using direct instruction reading a textbook, which is excellent, and Doug Carnine was the first author of it. And so it broke it down. It had lessons to model and lessons to practice. Excellent, okay? Then I moved to another university where I was teaching in special ed, so I could teach all of that. But it was a whole language department. First of all, it raised a red flag to me because my background had been research-based. And that's still exactly what I'm looking at. In fact, I'm very involved in the evidence-based work that's being done by Doug Carnine and Linda Diamond on what is the best research policies. Now, I'm just going to give the readers a hint of what to look for. So, what this agency is trying to do is to create a base of knowledge from research, not opinion, but research, and looking at three areas of research, which is the research that we would category under the science of instruction, second, the science of learning, and then the science of literacy or the science of math. Okay? And so they are vetting. Here is a study and looking at the quality of the study, and that is going into this base of advocacy materials available to legislators, to principals, to teachers. But watch for these next fall because we're ending the year, but they have also written what are called a canon of literacy, a canon of mathematics. That is summarizing the research. It's going to be a beautiful short book. Well, it's like 20, 150 pages, but short, that has been vetted. And so it's going to be very useful for a principal to have it, for you to have it, for me to have it, for other districts. And so many times questions that people have were answered in it. So we'll have a research base that will be extraordinarily useful. Now, so if you want to go online, if you look at Evidence Advocacy Center, that will be extraordinarily helpful to you. But let's just take some examples. Okay, one question is, should we have children discover information and make it child-centered discovery? Or should we make it where we have very explicit teaching of knowledge? Well, if you look at the science of instruction, it concluded that it was helpful for humans who are novices to be taught directly by experts, which are the teachers, like teaching helps. And then when you become an expert, then you could expand it through discovery. But that's not where our students are at. We get them at the novice stage. So the research on that from all three of those areas of science is going to be approached in those two canons. One on literacy, one on mathematics. Another question, just a little question, like if we were teaching phonemic awareness in kindergarten, should it all be oral? I'll say the sounds, you say the word, or I'll say the word, you're going to say the sounds. Or should we couple it with letters? Like we're going to teach blending when we sound out words. We're going to teach segmenting when we spell a word by putting it into sounds. Well, what does research say? Research says that you might, like in pre-K, before letters are introduced, you might do oral activities. But the ones that are going to be really helpful to improve phonemic awareness, the ability to manipulate sounds, will be connected to letters. So if we were really looking at this like other professions, let's say medicine. For a long time, physicians who were surgeons did not wash their hands. And then they noticed that people were dying. Okay, and there was like an emergency, but it took a while to change the practice. But when there was data and research on it, woo, they did it. And then after that, medicine became more and more of a research-driven profession. That's right where we are. It is not enough. It is not enough. Our children deserve the best content and the best instruction possible every day. That is sort of our moral imperative with children. And that means higher education must be really looking at what they're teaching. Are the students skilled? As they wouldn't send out a doctor that was not skilled. Well, we're not going to have philosophy classes. We're going to have, let's learn what we know about explicit instruction. Let's learn what we know about guided practice. Let's learn about what we know about space practice. Let's learn when you take a reading class, what we know about. And so that's what these canons are coming out. And I read the first one and I said, wow. And they're doing something I really admire, and that is that they are publishing it out of the agency so it can be updated about like every 2 or 3 years, which if you publish a book, they're not going to let you update it all that often. So this is the movement starting with higher education, but a movement across the country. It happened in reading with you got to teach phonics. The research said that students need to learn letter sound associations. They need to be able to blend words. They need to read multisyllabic words. They need to. And so, whole language then had to take, we haven't gotten rid of it totally, but the research is there and it is consistent. And we can vet the best studies and share those with people.
I do encourage everyone listening here to check out the Evidence Advocacy Center. I'll put some links in the show notes. And I definitely think you should go and listen to Doug Carnine's episode, which is, by the way, one of the top three episodes listened to on this podcast. Go check it out. And even if something like this sounds like it's just for policy people or it just sounds like it's top down only, we as teachers in the grassroots need to meet these two places in the middle. And so becoming informed and advocating for yourself, a lot of us figure out, Anita, that like pretty soon into the profession, that this is just weird. We thought it was something a little bit more sophisticated or based on something. And then you sort of do a little bit of homework and you realize it's not nearly as coherent, and it's certainly we're often adopting pretty ineffective practices just by default, which is not good.
As Reed Lyon always says, Reed Lyon, who was very much in charge of reading first, but is that it is a time where opinion is simply not enough. When you're thinking about the future of children, the future of our students, the future of our nations is not enough. We have to use research-validated practices.
Absolutely. Well, here's the last thing. I've taken up so much of
Okay.
your time. I am so I
I've
so
been
appreciate
delighted. Yes, Zach, it is a delight to talk to someone who has the same body of knowledge.
it. Well, I know that we're going to be meeting up at NIFTY, which is the National Institute for Direct Instructions,
Right.
conferences and institutes in 2026. And so you've presented and you've keynoted there many times. You're a friend of the organization. What are you doing this year? And I've been told by Kurt Engelman and Brian Wickman, like, kind of keep some of the mystery there. But what can we expect from you this year?
Well, you can expect research-validated practices being shared. That's for sure. So, for people who do not know this dichotomy, the words big DI and little DI. Okay, let me just explain this. So, big DI came out of the usage of explicit instruction, particularly that was followed with Zig Engelmann and his team to embed it in curriculum materials. So they did all of this, critical content, explicit instruction in the acquisition level, then guided practice in the we do it, and then lots of practice afterwards. And what they did, though, is much what curriculum programs don't often do. They took the wording of every lesson that they taught, field tested it, changed it to optimize student learning. Whoa. And so this conference will have people come who are going to teach or who are going to administer or who are going to coach what we call big DI programs that then became a curriculum that was scripted. And so I looked at which ones have sessions like reading mastery, corrective reading, connecting math concepts, correcting math, spelling mastery. All of those are big DI. So little DI would be programs or things that we've talked about in this whole thing where we're talking about what are the critical aspects from research. In terms of teacher practices that could be used with any curriculum. And so I am doing the little DI conference because even these people who came, they might have adopted the reading and math program, but they still have to teach science and they have to teach social studies. So they have to be able to recognize these practices and apply them, just what we've talked about when we talked about planning. And so that's what we are going to be looking at. Selection of the curriculum. I do it, we do it, you do it. And we're going to look at the delivery skills that are used in all DEI programs, but could be used with any other program. So we're going to look at those, how to get the pace better, looking at videos and analyzing them. So it comes the day before the actual conference.
Awesome. And I think they really do go hand in hand, like you said, because it's hard with any complex repertoire of behaviors to transfer between different contexts. And so being able to think deeply about that, how these principles come to life in a subject where you don't have a program is important. The other thing, the reverse, I've heard you say this before, and I just want to point it out because I don't think anyone has really said it. And that is that practicing with a scripted program or a DI program in particular seems to like teach you things almost implicitly about how to do things when you don't have one. It's the strangest thing, you
Yeah,
know?
you know. Zach, that is so critical because many people who've taught DI programs, maybe they taught corrective reading, and they say, "Ooh, now I know what kind of corrections I should give. Now I know that using the language consistently was important. Oh, now I see how they broke it down. Now I see how they." And so, yes, and so much so that I'm working with a number of universities in their teacher ed program, where often the first practicum is go out and watch teachers teach, but we can't guarantee what the instruction is. So we are having doing this, which I think is terrific. The very first practicum at these universities is now a tutoring to children, okay? But using a DI program. And they happen to be using one I wrote, Phonics for Reading or Rewards. But they have to study these scripts. They have to see how it's broken down. They have to see how they can gain and maintain attention. They can, and so it's absolutely right away, they have the right idea about teaching. That it is, yes, you greet the student at the door, you smile at them, but it is utilizing certain practices that are research validated.
I love it. Okay, so we will see each other this summer. I think we're talking a lot about Evidence Advocacy Center as well. Anita, I couldn't think of anyone better to close out this season for us. You are a legend, and I'm just so happy that we can cross
Thanks.
paths and that you've supported me through talking about my book
Yeah.
and so on. I cannot thank you enough. I am so grateful.
It's so interesting because I was asked, and I'll see if this is right here. I was asked, what is your philosophy of life? And you're a part of this. And George Bernard Shaw said this. This is what I'm doing at 79. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle to me. I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it over to future generations. Go, Zach.
Thank you. I will take the baton, but I think you've still got a lot of years in this left. Seeing how you draw a crowd and can manage a room, in some of the conferences we've been together. I think you've got a lot more. You've got a lot more in you. It's just
Luckily, I'm
fantastic.
blessed with energy. Yes, and you are too. So may you thrive and may I thrive and may all teachers thrive because this is what leads to children being more competent adults, our nation having more competent citizens, and our nation moving forward in the view that we have of the importance of education.
Perfect. And with
Perfect.
that, thank you so much, Dr. Archer, for your insights and for coming on the podcast. Listeners, please, you're so welcome to spread this around and have a great summer. If you're
Right.
listening to this right before the
Have a
summer,
good one.
take a break and then come back for the next season. We'll keep on churning out episodes one at a time.
Thank you. Thank you, Zach.